And I'm going to change how the agenda is listed, and I will want to spend half the time on with starting out with Senate Bill 618, and then the second half probably around about 10 to 2 start, or 5 to 2 start on Senate Bill 501. So, with that, I would like to open a public hearing on 618, and I'd like to call Bob Ackerman, and I know that Senator Brown and Senator Burdick, if you're out there, please come on down. We'd love to have you start this wonderful bill on its way.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Bob Ackerman. I'm a state representative. I represent House District 13, which is in North Eugene. I'm here this afternoon to support Senate Bill 618. 2 years ago tomorrow, I gave testimony in support of a similar bill, Senate Bill 783, which I co-sponsored with Senator Burdick. I still believe this is an important and positive bill for both nursing mothers who work and the employers who employ them. Senate Bill 618 requires an unpaid period for mothers to breastfeed or express milk, provided the activity does not cause an undue hardship upon the employer's business. The following benefits will result from this legislation. First, nursing mothers can return more quickly to the job market. Second, employers will have save additional labor costs associated with replacing an employee who is sent home to breastfeed a child. And third, breastfeeding is promoted and will result in better nutrition and health for infants. It should be relatively easy for an employer to make a reasonable effort to provide a room or other private location for this important and vital activity. The employer is not required to provide a rest period if it is shown to impose an undue hardship upon the operation of the employer's business, which I believe in most cases it will not. Senate Bill 618 is pro-family, pro-children, pro-business, and deserves your wholehearted support. Thank you for your testimony, for your opportunity to present this testimony this afternoon.
Thank you, Representative Ackerman, my old next-door neighbor. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. I really appreciate your taking up the Senate Bill 618, which is a very important bill for health of infants and mothers. And I also want to thank my colleague here, Representative Ackerman, for his ongoing support. For the record, I'm Ginny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18, which includes Southwest Portland, Tigard, and King City. Senate Bill 18 is a wonderful measure, pro-family, as Representative Ackerman said, to require employers simply to provide a safe, clean, convenient area where employees can breastfeed or express milk, in addition to unpaid rest periods for employees to feed their infants or express milk. As an editorial in the Oregonian reported last month, the American Academy of Pediatrics has issued its strongest recommendation to date, urging mothers to breastfeed for at least the first 6 months and preferably for a year after giving birth. Babies that are breastfed have a documented reduced incidence of infectious disease, as well as reduced rates of sudden infant death syndrome, diabetes, asthma, and obesity. Would someone please feed that baby? Thank you. Nursing mothers also enjoy health benefits themselves, such as reduced risks of breast and ovarian cancer. Breastfeeding is now widely recognized as much the preferred method of feeding infants and young children. And I can personally attest to the benefits of breastfeeding a baby. I breastfed my now 17-year-old daughter, if you can believe that, for 2.5 years. During that time, she never had a sick baby trip to the doctor, except for the time she ate the pull tab off of a soft milk can. But nothing aside from that. She didn't like the x-ray machine much either. After she weaned herself, we both found out, to our surprise, that she was very susceptible to ear infections. Thanks to nursing, we did not have to deal with these ear infections when she was small and especially vulnerable to them. She was almost 3 years old by the time the ear infection started. I believe that employers would find that supporting nursing mothers would more than pay for itself, not only in increased well-being of the mother and baby, but also in fewer absences from work to take care of sick children, because they simply don't get sick nearly as often when they're breastfed. As you will hear others testify, Senate Bill 618 will provide nursing mothers at work with more opportunity to freely and safely feed their infant. And I, again, want to express my appreciation for your taking up this bill today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thanks, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown. I'm here to say me too. Everything Senator Burdick says, I totally and completely agree with. The only fact I would add is that the World Health Organization recommends 18 months of breastfeeding for both the health of the infant and the mother. I worked a couple sessions ago to pass legislation allowing women to breastfeed in public. I think this is an extension. I think it just grows out of my experience of the at the ripe old age of 44. Most women have children tend to be younger than I am, and not all. When I was 25 or 30, I don't think I would have had the comfort level to go ask my employer for either time or appropriate space to express milk, and now it wouldn't be any problem. Woe to my future employers. But I just think that it's just a really difficult conversation for young people to have with their employers, and I just think we need something in statute. I know that the business community has expressed concerns. I think we can all work together and put a requirement in the law with that won't raise any eyebrows. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time and energy, and we appreciate you moving this issue forward.
Great. Comments?
I would.
Senator George.
You know, many of us who went through the situation in which our wives at a time, because my oldest daughter is now 40, in which this was politically incorrect, you know, to be nursing children. And I'm very thankful for my mom who said, no, this is the right thing to do, encourage my wife, you know, to take the appropriate steps to make sure the children were provided for in that way, and we have five very healthy children. But I mean, the very fact of the sociological change that's occurred to address the fact, which the old timers always knew, this is very healthy for the babies.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, it truly is. It's also healthier for the moms, and I think your comment about it's now socially or politically correct is totally true. I think what's happening now in terms of the workforce is that, you know, we see more and more women coming into the workforce, more and more women raising families and men helping them raise families while they're working, and I think it's really difficult to raise families while you're working full time, and I think we as a state need to say we really support these folks, these families, and this is one little way of doing that. So I'm with you.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Thank
right.
you.
Thank you.
I want to call the Nursing Mothers Council, Dr. Jim Lace and Christy Emerson and
Audrey,
I think. That sounds good. Go ahead, Dr. Okay. Lace.
Chairman Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon. And I have also represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 618. I'm going to take a slightly different bent. You've got my written testimony there, and I'm just going to focus in on a couple of things. We can go through the list of medical benefits for the child, medical benefits for the mother if you want, or you can read what we have down here. You've heard some of those already. What I'm going to tell you is, first off, I'm the managing partner for a pediatric clinic here in town. We have 45 employees, so I don't know if I'm a small business or a moderate business or whatever kind of size business, but so I represent actually a part of me that's an employer, and we have had four nursing mothers in the recent past. We have a room set off for them, accommodate their time. They can go and express or nurse the baby. We have two more moms coming up with babies, and so it's a worked out routine in our office. We don't find that to be a hardship. You think, well, you're a doctor's office, come on, give us a break. But nonetheless, we accommodate them, they appreciate it, and it took a little bit of effort to do that. And then there's also some potential disgruntlement from other people who think, wait a minute, they're getting extra time or extra attention, whatever. But we try to follow the bully laws, you know, where every 4 hours you got to have a 10-minute break, and if you work longer than 6 hours, you got to include a lunch break. And between the breaks that are included, you know, under mandate from bully, this works out pretty well. And if they need more time than that, then it's an unpaid, you know, break time. So it's easy to do. It's not painful. It's not a hardship as far as we can tell. So as an employer, I want to express that. I'm going to spend just a little bit of time on childhood obesity. You all have heard me talk about here. Senator Courtney has, you know, championed Senate Bill 228. We talked about some other bills dealing with childhood obesity. One of the things that I want to leave with you is that if we have a way to reduce the incidence of childhood obesity, actually prevent it right out of the chute, I think that's a worthwhile goal for all of us to pursue. And if you look at studies, and you can argue with studies, you can argue with statistics, but if I tell you that 15 to 25% of childhood obesity can be prevented with moms who breastfeed for at least 6 months, that's wonderful. Are there any studies that show that breastfeeding increases childhood obesity? No. So it's either, you know, you either reduce the risk or at least, you know, keep it the same. But most of the studies are on the side of reducing childhood obesity. So you've all heard the numbers that we spend, you know, up to $200 million a year from the state budget treating obesity-related conditions, not only in children but in adults. So if we can reduce that, and even I guessed in here and I put down a number of maybe, you know, $10 or $20 million. I'm not sure if that's really true or not. But if we can actually start impacting it now, reduce the incidence of childhood obesity, and likewise the adult obesity epidemic that we're having, I think that's a very worthwhile goal, and we all want to, you know, pursue that. The other thing that we want to encourage, there's a lot of things that are unique about human breast milk. It is designed for only one animal species, namely humans. Formula makers are always trying to tweak their formulas to add things in to make them more like breast milk. They never match it quite the same, and there's nothing like breast milk. If you look at other animal species, every animal has its own milk, you know, that's designed for it. A whale's milk is 80% fat because they need all this huge calorie hit, but ours is, you know, just for our, for, you know, designed for babies. If I told you that you'd get an extra 5 IQ points by being breastfed versus not being breastfed, you'd say, that sounds like a pretty good idea. I'd take the extra 5 IQ points. And so there's evidence to support that. The last thing I'll leave with you is that the government and society has banded together before to fight an epidemic. We're facing the obesity epidemic now. If you look at cigarette usage in this country, we are back down to the pre-World War II cigarette usage now. This is from the CDC, because of efforts by the government and efforts by society at large to actually address this. So this is only one part of the obesity issue, but I think it's a huge thing if we can prevent that along with all the other diseases. So I'll close up my testimony there and take any questions.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Doctor, did you mention the immune system?
I didn't. No, like I said, that's in my written testimony. I'm happy to go on for hours if you want. You talk about infections, and 21% decrease incidence in life-threatening infections, which is huge. I mean, now you're talking about, you know, is it as good as vaccines for some diseases? And, you know, we spend money on vaccines. We get a 10 for every $1 we invest, we get a $10 return on vaccines. This could potentially be even more than that, because it's really no cost to the state in terms of investing to prevent serious infections.
Great. All right. Audrey? For the record, introduce yourself.
My name is Audrey Lungershausen. This is my daughter, Zola. She's 2.5, and we're here to tell you about my personal experience. I am an architectural designer, a title that means that I have a master's degree in architecture. And I'm going to read. I'm sorry, that's the best I can do right now. It's from an accredited university, and it also means that I completed a required 3-year minimum internship While in graduate school, I was a recipient of two different national awards for academic ability and design achievements. I've designed underground restrooms at Reed College, parts of Reed College, remodels for Meyer and Frank, parts of North Clackamas High School, etc. Today, I have close to 8 years' worth of experience working in architecture at various firms and also as a private practitioner now that she's with me. So, I'm currently an instructor in art and architecture at the Multnomah Art Center, and I work part-time from home on residential remodels. I wrote my master's thesis on the idea that female architects design differently than male architects. I wrote this in 1995. The idea was that my body moves through the built environment much differently than my husband's, but why were all bathrooms, for example, designed with male standards? The counterintuitive space for my intuitive body presented a disconnect, and would the female architect design it differently? I passed my thesis, graduated, and in my wake, a small insurgency began where groups like Women in Architecture were formed at my school. This was not my goal at all. My thesis was unanswered, but I did discover plenty of ideas and objective about how space is used by our bodies. The other thing you should know about me is that I'm able to nurse babies with my breasts. It's just a fact. I plan to return to work after the classic unpaid 3 months leave of absence, and at 5 months post-baby, my boss called and asked me back. They had a lot of work in the office, and they needed me. I put him off with the excuse that the daycare I targeted had no space yet. They called again when Zola was 10 months old, and I said I would try to come back. I was breastfeeding 5 or 6 times a day and thought that I could start pumping at the office. And I should mention here that before departing for maternity leave, I'd had many conversations about its legal implications. In fact, I was asked to research, write, and propose the office standard for maternity leave, as they did not have one. I want to point out that my former employer is an architectural namesake that has been in Portland since 1911. And they didn't have a maternity leave policy. Anyway, initially I assumed I could come back to the office and pump breast milk and work, but we never discussed pumping because I thought it would be a private endeavor. It's a private mission. But when I was asked back the second time, I said we couldn't afford daycare instead. I didn't talk about pumping because it just was private to me. What I really wanted was test my boss where I would be pumping breast milk. It would be a rhetorical question because I already knew the answer. I couldn't believe the logistics. It meant choosing between a bathroom stall where people defecate and the blueprint room where a bottle of industrial-strength ammonia was left open for the machine to function. I knew I couldn't pump in either and officially gave my job up for those reasons. Put yourself in my shoes for a moment. Do you like hanging out in office building restrooms? Pumping takes about 20 minutes at minimum. Have you ever used a blueprint machine or been near industrial strength ammonia? It stinks and it emits gases of questionable safety. What was best for Zola? Formula is an expensive chemical. It costs on average $1,800 a year, but I'm not here to discuss that. I'm here to ask you why my choices for pumping were limited. I am any woman, and if I did not have a fancy master's degree and a career path, and instead worked at Burger King, the paradigm is the same, and the question remains the same. Where can we pump? Where can we pump, really? It's been 2.5 years since I chose to leave my full-time job with benefits as an architectural designer. The financial impact of my choice has been tremendous. We've barely gotten by. I can say, thank God, I have a wonderful husband and a healthy, happy toddler. I can teach her to identify choices that are supported by society and to recognize choices with a future. Most importantly, I can hope that one day her choices will not include the limitations I've experienced that reduce her professionally when she starts family. And that's about all I have to say.
Great.
If you have any questions, go for it.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'm going to have just two more proponents, Teresa, Mindy, or Linda Nelson and Catherine Abdir, and then I'm going to have an Association of Oregon Industries testify. And if I can request you to, since we have 12 people and only about 35 minutes left, to limit it to about 2 to 3 minutes, I would really appreciate it.
All right. Chair Moniz, Anderson, members of the committee, thank you very much for having the opportunity to speak on behalf of the women that I serve in Southern Oregon. My name is Catherine Abdener. I'm a board-certified lactation consultant, and I work in the hospital setting, Three Rivers Community Hospital in Grants Pass. My work is exclusively with breastfeeding mothers and their children and their families. I do feeding assessments and interventions. I educate staff and providers and do community outreach. I was team leader in 1999 for our hospital's baby-friendly designation, and we're the 21st such hospital in the United States, which means that we meet the standards that are set forth by the World Health Organization and UNICEF to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding. I'm a little nervous.
Doing great.
Thank you. Of the approximately 800 births that we have in our facility every year, that we have very, very high breastfeeding initiation rates, about 92 to 97%. And that's even higher than many other places in Oregon. And traditionally, the Pacific Northwest does very well with initiating breastfeeding. But then our rates drop off significantly. Most of the mothers in my client population will tell me that they return to work at about anywhere between 4 weeks to 12 weeks. And many of those mothers, in fact, most of those mothers will stop breastfeeding by the time they return to work because they're not comfortable asking for support from their employers to pump. They're not confident that they'll have a supportive environment. And a couple of examples that I've given you. Oh, by the way, we serve approximately 67% low-income population with a large rural population base. And many of these women are the women that we've been hearing about already this morning that don't have the confidence and the social awareness and composure and confidence to seek support from their employers in this private area, as it was addressed earlier. It's very well put. I have a couple of examples. One of the mothers that I recently worked with works on a utility crew, and at 4 weeks she weaned her baby because she felt that she would be unsupported in the workplace. Her supervisor and male crew members, she did not feel comfortable even bringing up the idea of having the opportunity to pump for her baby. And so that issue she decided without even addressing it. If there were a bill that supported her right to do so, then certainly she would have the confidence. Think about a woman utility crew member. I mean, she's working with the guys out there in all kinds of weather conditions, and she needed to know that what she was going to do was going to be supported and that she had the right to do so. And no one at this point, that's not available. Another woman that I worked with is a guard at one of our jails, and during her pregnancy she needed frequent bathroom breaks. And if any of you have been pregnant during the latter stages of pregnancy, you're often in the restroom, and every time she went to the restroom she needed to be relieved by a guard. And she was so harassed by this coworker that she did not return to her workplace after her baby was born because she knew she would not get the support that she needed to have time to express her milk and pump her milk for her baby. Maintaining a milk supply is dependent on regular stimulation. So women who go back...
then?
Yes, I will. So... this is more than about a legislative issue that protects... a secure, strong attachment to mother becomes the foundation for future attachments. That impacts the mental and physical health in ways that are difficult to measure. We know, however, that when parents and their children are not well attached, it can lead to maladaptive behaviors. And this is truly more than an employee-employer issue needing legislative action. This issue is fundamental for today's women and their children, which protects the mother-child bond in the face of partial separation, which occurs during the workday. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Teresa Mude. I'm a family physician in Coos Bay. I'm also an employer and a mom that continued to breastfeed returning to work. And unlike Dr. Lace, I can be quite sure that I am actually a small business. Our office consists of four people. For the small businesses who say this is an undue hardship, I can't possibly spare a few minutes for that one employee, let me just say that I'm very happy that our office had fully 75% of our population pumping breast milk at the same time. Oh, and we live to tell about it. And in fact, my partner is pregnant again, and my medical assistant, who we hired shortly after we returned to work, is also pregnant again, and my medical assistant that I've now spent a year and a half training is definitely coming back to work because she knows that she can continue to pump milk when she goes back to work. I don't have to train someone new. I don't have to look for a new employee. I asked one of my colleagues before I came back how he handled it with his single office nurse, and his answer was pretty simple. He said, I'm a pediatrician. I have to make it work. And that's the paradigm that I want employers to think about. You know, a lot of the mothers I see as patients need to return back to work to support their families. They don't have an option to stay home, but they really want to take care of their baby the best they can. They also don't have a lot of spare cash to buy formula. But, you know, they've just been on a maternity leave. They don't want to ask for a special favor. Can I just please have a little extra break time? Can I just please have a little private place? And what Senate Bill 618 does is it normalizes breastfeeding. It's kind of looking back to our labor laws that said, yes, it's normal for someone to take a break to go to the bathroom or to have a break for lunch. And if you expect your colleagues to go have lunch, why shouldn't you expect your colleagues to go feed their babies? The mothers who successfully continue breastfeeding after returning to work have two things in common, both planning and the will to make it happen. And a law supporting breastfeeding really, I've heard this several times, it serves as a springboard to have that conversation with your employer. You're not asking for a special accommodation. You're not asking for favors. Amazingly, most women who think about this ahead of time and can talk to their employers have much more luck than women who go back and just try to, well, I suspect that this will happen. I have two mothers. Kim is a second grade teacher in Coos Bay. She took 8 weeks off, had to go back to work, had made arrangements with her colleagues, who were all very supportive, but was afraid to ask for a place to go. She had a bathroom in her classroom. The door didn't shut because the cord had to go outside to plug in the pump. After a month, she had no more breast milk. On the other hand, a patient of mine, Brandy, returned to a workplace where three other moms had been pumping. She knew where she'd go. She knew that it would be okay. She was able to return to work a little bit sooner than she had anticipated, which made her boss very happy because they were struggling without her. And she was able to breastfeed her baby for a year. Her family, which had a big history of asthma, allergies, frequent ear infections, her family history put her child at risk. Her child had only one ear infection in that first year.
Can you sum up?
Yeah, as we, you know, as a physician, I'll say, as we struggle to find funding for the Oregon Health Plan and other medical needs of Oregonians, we need to look at means to reduce costs. If we had a vaccine that reduced hospitalizations for infectious diarrhea, that reduced rate of sudden infant death syndrome, that reduced lifetime prevalence of allergies and obesity, if it made diapers less smelly, we would be looking for the funding to provide it for every child. We have this vaccine. It's free. In fact, it's cheaper than the alternative. I think that we, as employers, need to just make it happen. And I hope that you, as lawmakers, will say, we just have to make it happen.
Great. Thank you.
Madam Chair, not a question for this panel necessarily.
Okay.
And for the record, I'm supportive of breastfeeding, and my wife is adamant about it. it's not. But Section 3, Sub 4, where it says, an employer shall make reasonable efforts to provide room or other location, kind of a vague statement, and I would, when these panelists are describing conditions, I would be interested to know what they would consider to be reasonable, just so we kind of have a context on that.
Well, I think we'll bring Julie Brandis up now, and who else with you, Julie? Okay. And is someone from Boley here?
Yeah.
The Bureau of Labor. Do you want to come up to and
warn you in advance that I'm the Administrator of the Civil Rights Division, and this deals a lot with wage and hour issues. But as you look at the bill, it invokes both statutes, so I'll do my best to
Okay. All right. All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. As a point of clarification, I think AOI's position on breastfeeding in the workplace has been misrepresented by the press. We are obviously very supportive of breastfeeding opportunities in the workplace. My own association has a very pro-breastfeeding organization. We have a great room. We have great opportunities. And I think you'll see in the survey that many of our members are also very pro-breastfeeding. And I did this as a favor to Senator Burdick and Senator Walker after last session. We conducted a survey, Mark Nelson, of many of you who know, conducted a survey for us. Questions 2, 3, and 4 are directly related to breastfeeding. The first question asks, when working mothers who are breastfeeding return from maternity leave, does your company provide time for them to express milk? 44% of the 300 company CEOs that we interviewed said, yes, we do. 14% did say, no. And 42% said not sure. And I think, keep in mind, we're interviewing the CEOs of the companies. So they might not actually understand what their HR policies are. They're worried about global environments and so on. And then when we looked into why the companies didn't provide breastfeeding time or time to express milk, 73% responded they didn't have female employees or didn't apply. It has 17% said it hasn't been an issue. And I think this is a point that Senator Brown articulated very well. I think there is still a social issue about approaching your boss about finding time to breastfeed. And that might show, that might be reflective of that. I don't know. I didn't get asked follow-up questions. And then as you go down the list, you can see, you know, family-run business, small business, limited breaks, time off only, that type of thing. The next question that we did in this point of view survey is the time provided to express milk flex time when it is convenient or when it is limited? So again, we went back to the original 44% who said, yeah, we have time to express milk. 76% responded that they do this within their flex time leave policies. And I think that's important for you as lawmakers and regulators to understand. Flex time is a huge benefit to employees. I have a daughter who has an IEP and special ed. I no longer breastfeed. I did at AOI. But now I can utilize my flex time at AOI to work with the school district to help her along so that she can be successful in school. That's the benefit of flex time. The more regulations you mandate upon the HR department, the harder flex time becomes. So I ask you to keep that in mind when you think about how to create a solution to address the concerns of the mothers in the audience today and the families in the audience. So when we look at legislation like this, you might hear somebody say, AOI is opposed to this bill. Well, as you all know, because you've all had the class from the judges, we have to look at the letter of the law. And we have to educate HR managers throughout the state how to implement a law. And as this bill is written, it is extremely difficult to implement. Senator Cruz, you asked a very good question. What is reasonable? Reasonable pervades the law. We have seen it in family leave bills. We have seen it in ADA bills. What defines reasonable is generally a court case. So let's take a look at some of the concerns we have within the legislation. I have agreed with Senator Mona Sanderson and the proponents of the bill to meet as early as tomorrow morning so we can start working on something we all feel good about and that you know, we hopefully can all support. But let's look at some of the concerns when we look at the letter of the law. The language is confusing in the bill because it starts out by saying reasonable unpaid rest period, but later says the employees must provide 60 minutes per 8-hour shift. So does that mean anything less than 60 minutes isn't reasonable? I don't know. I don't know what to tell the HR manager when he or she calls. What if an employee works less than an 8-hour time period? For example, I don't work 8 hours at AOI except for during this 8 hours a day except for during the session. Does the required break time increase or decrease proportionally? I don't know. And I don't know what to tell an HR manager who's implementing this. The bill states that 30 minutes is considered normal break time. This is an arbitrary number. Oregon's law requires up to 10 minutes of rest period in the morning and then a lunch, a 30-minute like lunch break, if you work an 8-hour shift. If you don't work an 8-hour shift, you probably would have a 10-minute morning and a 10-minute afternoon break. We suggest, whatever you decide as a committee and as lawmakers, to tie the times that are required for break time and such to the BOLI statutes, because they may change at some point. Finally, an employer may make reasonable efforts to, the bill states, an employee may make reasonable efforts to allow an employee to temporarily change job duties if the employee's regular job duties do not allow breastfeeding or expressing of milk. You, as legislators, have spoken on these issues. You have told employers, under no circumstance may you return a woman or anyone returning from family leave to any other position except the exact same position. So what do I tell an HR manager? The law requires you, when a woman returns from work, that if she's the energy lobbyist at AOI, no matter who's been filling that position, she still gets to be the energy lobbyist at AOI with the same pencil sharpener, with the same chair, at the same desk. It's clear. So now you're asking us to try and implement something else to that. Please help us clarify that within the statute so we know as HR managers in our companies how to accommodate women returning from work and nursing mothers or fathers returning from family leave. The bill requires employers to provide, I think I've said finally like three times, but actually I have a couple more points. So the bill requires employers to provide reasonable efforts to breastfeed or express milk. Those are two different things. And it's two different accommodations for the employer. One is bringing a child into the office, and the other is bringing a breast pump into the office. Now, my boss is pretty flexible. He runs a daycare of lobbyists. He lets us bring our children to work anytime we need to, but we're not supposed to take advantage of that. So are we accommodating breastfeeding, or are we accommodating expressing of milk with a breast pump in the office place? So the other thing that's important is we don't know how long, especially if we have to find a new position or accommodate that person for a new position, we don't know how long we have to do that for, because the proposed statute does not speak to that. So are we, I breastfed for 18 months. So does the employer have to accommodate you in a substitute position for 18 months, or is it temporary, or how long? You know, we are not, as the proponents have said to the press, trying to pepper this legislation with questions or concerns. We are trying to express that the employer mandates that you all support can be very complicated when implemented in a company. And if all the what-ifs are not addressed here in this committee, on the Senate floor, on the House floor, and in the House committee, we end up being the people who have to try to answer that and keep our members out of court or out of circumstances that are very uncomfortable with their employees, who they need. So I hope that clarifies our position and some of the research that we did try to do to help you with your jobs during the interim.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Yes. Senator Morissette.
Oh. Well, you didn't address Section 6, but I think you...
The reasonableness?
Indirectly, you did. The penalties involved for not...
Oh.
Because I support the bill, I'm very anxious to pass something out, but I too am troubled a little bit by the reasonable thing, because it leaves some room, and then there are penalties involved.
Yes, sir.
Some civil suits and so on and so forth. So I think it if it can be tightened... I would hope it could.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess one of the things that's not in the bill, and I wonder if it becomes an issue, is if a woman is expressing milk, what does she do with it? I mean, obviously, you can't leave it for 4 or 5 hours at room temperature.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And members of the committee.
that might not pass USDA standards.
You can leave your breast milk that long. Most breast pumps today, and I almost brought. We have one that we just keep at AOI. We actually have two or three, I think. We keep at AOI. So if you ever want to see one, you can come over for a visit. But we have a refrigerator at AOI, and as long as we mark it so people like John Ledger don't accidentally use it. We won't talk about circumstances that have arisen with this in the past. No. But most breast pumps are equipped with a little, a cooler device and little ice packets that you can put in them and keep them very fresh.
And pardon my ignorance, it just seemed to me that that was something that should be addressed, and obviously Mother Nature's taking care of it. So,
Madam Chair?
Yes. For the record, my name is Amy Clare, and I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division, and we prepared written testimony on the measure, so I won't go over that, but I did want to put on the record that the Commissioner supports the concept, the concepts expressed in Senate Bill 618 in both the Wage and Hour Division and the Civil Rights Division, because this includes wage and hour issues under 653, and then the Civil Rights Division enforces anti-discrimination statutes, which would include the reasonable accommodation and the retaliation. We're happy to work with both sides of this issue to try to work this out in terms such as reasonableness and what a reasonable person would do. We have those already, and we define those in rule, and we could work with both parties if this were to pass to draft administrative rules that would clarify a lot of that. And I'd like to make a pitch for our technical assistance unit. If you call the Bureau of Labor and Industries, we have a separate division that is called the Technical Assistance Unit, and they will answer questions confidentially of employers who have questions about any of these laws. I know it's confusing. Ms. Brandis is really accurate about saying there's a lot of confusing laws. Sometimes I get confused. I have to go back and look at the rules and the statutes, especially in family leave. But they're there to help, and it's no cost if you call.
Okay. I have a question regarding flexibility. I know it's my understanding that if you're required to have a 15-minute or a 10-minute break in the morning, and then you have a half-hour lunch. But what about flexing those? I mean, it seems reasonable to flex hours throughout the day so that you have 10, 10, 10, or 15, 15, 10, whatever. And it's my understanding that statute is such that there's not that flexibility.
You're correct, Chair Monis Anderson. I'm not the wage and hour expert, but I will say that when she was testifying, not every employee, even our own employees, have flex time. The professional staff are under a different standard than those that are covered by the minimum wage standards. So we could work with you on that. But as a professional staff myself, I have the ability to flex my schedule, but some of the support administrative staff, they don't. It's up to the discretion of their supervisor, at least under where I'm working at the Bureau of Labor and Industry.
Well, when we look at working this bill, and I don't plan to pass it out today, but I do want to pass it out at some point, I would really like us to take a look at, I don't know if there's exemption rules I would like people to start, when you're talking, looking at that so that we want to avoid litigation at all costs. And I'm just very concerned that if a complaint is brought up, if an employer doesn't allow flexibility under current law, is he really sanctioned? Are they sanctioned?
Right.
I mean, would Bowley then say, sorry, you're fine because you provided some flexibility.
Madam Chair, I can't speak too much for the Wage and Hour Division, although our website goes into great detail about meals and rest periods, and actually after you've worked the better part of 4 hours, so that would be 2.5 hours, you're entitled to a 10-minute rest period, and there's lots of details on that. But we are complaint-driven, so we don't just go in and inspect to make sure. So that generally people contact the agency. We try to work it out, see if we can resolve something. At least in civil rights, we always try to settle claims rather than have to go forward.
Does the complaint have to come from an individual or an employee or the employer? Does it matter?
Madam Chair, generally in the Civil Rights Division, we get complaints generated from an individual, usually if you're talking about employment law, an employee. Under rare circumstances, if we hear something very egregious, the commissioner has the ability to file a commissioner's complaint. But I doubt it would happen under this statute.
You want to comment on that? Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell, also with AOI, and just wanted to comment. I don't disagree with anything that Ms. Clare has said, but I think that it is important, if you're going to have deliberations on this, that I think you would need a statutory change to address allowing some flexibility with the breaks and meal periods. I agree she's correct on professional staff and exempt employees, but I think the rules are pretty strict for non-exempt. And the issue is, for a lot of times for employers, is complaints are filed after a worker has quit, and occasionally they're starting to think of reasons that maybe they weren't happy. Sometimes the complaints don't come from the employee that was actually involved. Somebody else in the workplace sees something that they perceive as an injustice, and the complaint is submitted. And she's touched on some of the different ways that the complaints come forward. So I think that if you look at that as a possible solution, that it would require some statutory change to their rule. Their rules on breaks.
All right.
Thank you. Yes.
You mentioned that Boley could come up with some administrative rules, which is interesting, because if you came up with the administrative rules and had to then deal with them, you would understand them because you made them, right?
I mean, right. And
but my real question is, you're not suggesting that the bill be passed first and then the administrative rules, or you are?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, generally the legislation's passed, and we draft rules for their clarification and for it to implement.
Well, I guess the alternative to that would be to figure out what to do before you pass the bill. But what you are saying, though, is that a bill could be passed with the idea that rules would then be developed, because I'm afraid this thing could languish and die if we wait for everything to be perfect. So I guess I hear you saying that we can pass something and you can fix it and make it work.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's not exactly what I said. rules can be very contentious, and there was legislation passed last session that, you know, we have to bring together the interested parties and put together committees and try to. It's not consensus based, but it should be pretty close. So as much of it that can be defined in statute, that would be preferable.
Okay. Thank you,
okay. Yeah. Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, my good friend Senator Morissette. I guess I think, Madam Chair, if you're going to create a work group here, the fact is that this flex time is a huge thing. It's not just a simple adjustment. I think it would be absolutely prudent for us to try to get our hands on it in the bill rather than leave it totally to rule.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dirk, and then Senator Murphy.
The on page 2, line 18, with a temporary change of duty, seems to be an issue that definitely needs to be worked out if we have a conflict there.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And do we know how many other states actually have that kind of requirement on employers at this time?
Madam Chair, Senator George, are you asking about the requirement about the exact placement? I do not know. Hold on a second. Let me look back at my former colleague. Betsy still there? Betsy actually worked this issue quite a bit a few sessions ago. She actually might know, and I'll see if I can grab her in the hall.
Okay, we have 8 minutes left, and there are 6 people left. And so I would like to, do you want to?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did. We are planning to meet as early as tomorrow with Diane Garrett to start working on some ideas on addressing your concerns as well as ours.
Okay. Great. Now, I'm not sure who you are, but I know I want Martha Johnson, Cynthia Majab, and Catherine Bradley.
I'm Linda Welch.
Oh, you came in. Okay. Linda, do you want to start? Because I called
would.
Your name
yes,
a little
very
bit.
Yes, much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I had a prepared 3-minute speech here to discuss.
Do you want to identify yourself?
Excuse me?
Identify yourself first.
Oh, sorry. My name is Linda Welch. I work for a major world-class high-technology company here in Oregon. I'm 43, and I'm currently nursing my 22-month-old son. I spent 20 years in the high-tech industry as a systems architect, and about 3 years ago I made a career change to the legal department, where I perform patent infringement analysis. So you can imagine I did plenty of technical research on the benefits of breastfeeding. I'm also the breadwinner of my family, so I had to return to work after 8 weeks of maternity leave. And it became my number one priority to continue to breastfeed my son. I wanted to dispel some of the confusion and mystery of how breastfeeding in the workplace works. I had the luxury of working for an employer that emphasizes a culture of work-life balance. And they provide not only the flex time available for me to pump at work, but lactation rooms at all of its major sites in 9 states and 6 countries. I work at a 13-acre campus, so the time it takes me to actually pump the 3 times a day that is required in about 8 to 10 hour workday, I spend about 20 to 30 minutes total for each pump. I usually have to have a 5-minute walk to the other end of the campus where the nursing mother's room is. Those rooms are beautiful. They're designed by engineers to solve this problem. They're private. They're clean. They have sinks and cleaning supplies and refrigerators solely for breast storage. It takes about 20 minutes to set up your pump and pump. Okay? So for women who want to continue to supply enough milk in a day for their children, particularly early on, they need at least 3 opportunities a day to pump in an 8 to 10 hour day. I'm a professional, so I have flexible time, so I can pump whenever I want to. For the non-exempt employees that I work with in the department who also pump, Their managers have been flexible, allowing that time to sort of coincide with their break time in a flexible way. But I wanted to just address how much time is really needed here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So as a child gets older, the daytime demand for milk decreases, and it's possible for women to get by with maybe 2 or 1 pumps a day. But this can be done anywhere where you have a clean, hygienic facility. I mean, I've done this traveling. I've brought my infant son with me in business travel. I've pumped on airplanes, airport lounges, you name it, anywhere I had to accomplish this goal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Do we have time for one more or two more?
Just go with the flow.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'm Martha Johnson. I'm a registered nurse and board-certified lactation consultant currently working at Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene. I've been working with moms and babies for 18 years. I'm also a mom myself and a co-author of Senate Bill 618. What I'd like to do in my testimony is kind of connect the dots for you guys on some of the research, both from the medical literature and from statistics on working moms. Right now in Oregon, 46% of our workforce consists of women of childbearing age. So I think this is an issue that we need to deal with. It's not going to go away. If you look at the research on breastfeeding duration when moms return to paid employment, it's very well established. My bibliography and my testimony cites over a dozen studies that show when moms go back to paid work, they don't breastfeed as long as stay-at-home moms. There's also ample evidence that shows that when moms receive support in their workplace for breastfeeding, they manage to breastfeed quite a bit longer. So the next set of questions we have to ask is, why is that important? What difference does it make? You can look at, you've heard some of the other folks that testified speak to the health benefits of breastfeeding. What we know from the medical literature is that when mothers breastfeed for a shorter amount of time, they put themselves and their children at greater risk. I can tell you one recent example, and there's lots and lots more. The list is very long for all kinds of conditions and illnesses. But Dr. Marilyn Kwan published last November a study that showed kids who breastfed 6 months or less had a 12% risk reduction for childhood leukemia. Kids who were breastfed longer than 6 months had a 24% risk reduction. Now, if that's your kid or your grandkid, wouldn't you want them to have the lowest possible risk for something as serious as leukemia? That's the kind of evidence on which the Academy of Pediatrics bases its recommendation that every child should be breastfed for the first 12 months of life. And we're falling far short of that in our numbers on duration. Most women quit much, much sooner than that, and going back to work is one of the main reasons they do.
Now let's take all that statistics and connect it up to the workplace. A mom who goes back to work after the typical maternity leave somewhere between 6 and 12 weeks is going to need to continue breastfeeding for a number of more months to minimize all those health risks. Moms need support in order to combine breastfeeding with their paid work. And the support can be very simple. Like the gal who spoke just before me, people just need a clean place to pump and some flexible break time. The way things stand now, support for breastfeeding in the workplace is left up to chance. It's either a really assertive mom who's highly educated, articulate, and she's gonna make sure that her needs are met, or it's someone who's lucky enough to have an accommodating boss. I've worked with new moms for 18 years, and one of the things I've learned is that not every mom is resourceful enough or lucky enough to make breastfeeding work for her in her workplace. And I have to ask you, in light of the public health and the economic consequences of early weaning, does it really make sense to keep leaving something as important as this up to individual luck? So let's not forget to ask why businesses should accommodate their breastfeeding workers. What's in it for them? Companies that have breastfeeding support programs report cost savings of $3 for every dollar they invest in breastfeeding support. They have less absenteeism because moms aren't out as much taking care of sick kids. They have lower health care costs. That's an average savings of $400 to $1,000 per baby in the first year.
Can you sum up?
Yep. Better productivity and a family-friendly image in their community. I want you guys to know that we have sat down with AOI earlier in the session to discuss their concerns and needs around this issue. We're very willing to continue working with the business community, and our hope is to work together with them and with you all to put together a bill that can pass this session. This is my third time coming here with a bill like this.
All right.
I want to see this succeed.
Thank you very much.
All right. And is this Cynthia? Okay. All right, then Catherine and Cynthia Mojab, Good Mojab, and Deborah Hart.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, thank you very much. I am Catherine Bradley, Administrator of the Office of Family Health for the Department of Health Services, and we are speaking here today in support of Senate Bill 618. I have two brief points that I want to bring up that I don't think have been touched in the previous testimony. It is noted that the greatest barrier to breastfeeding for 1 year is returning to work. Rules for the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, our TANF program, require moms to return to full-time training or employment by the time their infants are 3 months old. Without significant employer support, children in these low-income families have little chance to having access to health protection for breastfeeding policies. And we see this as a particularly at-risk group that doesn't necessarily have the capability for advocacy in the positions that they're in. So we wanted to bring that point up. The second discussion that's come up several times has been the issue of the voluntary nature or the opportunity of having a voluntary program. I'd like to remind you or share with you the information that the Office of Family Health has actually for the last 6 years had a voluntary program known as the Breastfeeding Mothers Friendly Employer Project. This is a copy of our brochure. It's on our website. We have encouraged employers to actually develop workplace policies, create an environment that's conducive and supportive of flex time. We will acknowledge that and give them a certificate. We'll post them on our website. And to date, we have less than 40 employers in the state of Oregon that have actually participated in this. We have publicized this through the state Human Resources Managers Group and really would like to work with other employers, but that is a concern in terms of recognizing this has been a voluntary program that's been there that we've tried to work in conjunction, and it's not had the level of support. Now, there are many employers who may have these, have implemented this in their workplace, who have not chosen to check with us to get recognition for it, but it is an opportunity to have that happen. That's all I'll share with you at this time in light of it, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the Senate Committee on Health Policy, my name is Cynthia Goodmojab. For the record, I live in Hillsboro. I wear many hats in breastfeeding. I don't want to waste time telling you about that. It's in my testimony, written testimony. Researcher, author, work with moms. I agree with a great deal of testimony that's been presented today. One thing I'd like to emphasize in particular is that most people hear about the benefits of breastfeeding. Formula feeding is still the norm in our society, so we hold it as the norm. That's what we grew up with. That's what we perceive as acceptable, ordinary. And so we measure the health differences between the two, holding formula feeding as the norm. And so we see breastfeeding as having benefits, and you hear a lot of that benefits language everywhere. But when we recognize which one came first, breastfeeding or formula feeding, which one is the biological norm for our species, breastfeeding is the norm, and that is what we should be measuring health outcomes against. So that's where the risk language comes in, which packs a totally different emotional experience. Suddenly we're talking about the risks of formula feeding instead of the benefits of breastfeeding, and that can be emotionally difficult. People often wonder, well, what kind of risks are we talking about? I just want to highlight a couple. They're in my testimony. We're talking about 5 times greater risk of allergic symptoms. We're talking about out of 1,000 infants born every year, 4 will die because they don't breastfeed. These are numbers you don't normally come across. It shows that infant feeding is a major public health policy issue. It is often underestimated, and it cannot be overstated. The women who have the least power in the workforce are the ones who have the greatest risk of health and developmental issues among their children. And they're the ones who are in the greatest need of legislation to back them up in the workforce. They are not going to be the assertive, highly educated women, some of whom have spoken before you today. So my general points are this is a major public health issue, and we need legislation to protect the women that are trying to avoid the risks of formula feeding for their children. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Deborah Hart. I'm a mother of a 5-year-old and a 10-month-old. I'm also a CPA and an assistant director for an accounting department for a health care system. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 618 because I feel like we have an opportunity here in this state to make life better for nursing moms and their babies. I have 2 experiences that I think are important to share. I went back to work when my first child was 6 weeks old to an employer that I'm no longer with. The office moved while I was gone, and one of the things that I realized when I came back was that my private office space was gone. I had an office, but there were windows everywhere, and they no longer had blinds. I asked my employer if I could pay to have blinds installed, and I was told no. I then asked if I could clean out a bathroom that was being used for storage, a rather large one, and I was told no, that was needed for storage. The accommodation for me was a 4-foot by 5-foot screen at the end of the employee break room. I'm sorry, I'm nervous.
I'm doing great.
So for a month, I went up to the employee break room, which was also next to the bathroom, the refrigerator, and extra storage, and I went behind the screen and I pumped. People came up to use the bathroom, have their lunch, look for files, ask me questions about work while I was pumping. I was tense all the time. That doesn't help your milk supply any. One day, a board member walked behind the screen and talked to me before he realized what I was doing. At that point, I said, the bathroom's got to be better than this, the employee bathroom. I could barely squeeze a chair in so that I didn't have to sit on the toilet and pump. After a few weeks of that, I said, this is really absurd. I wouldn't bring a cup of coffee to drink in here. Why am I making my baby's food here? I went against the wishes of my boss. I cleaned out the storage room, and I said, it's going to be my lactation room. I was afraid that I would be disappointed for that. In the end, she was pleased. She said, great, that's the executive washroom now. And I shared it with her for a bathroom. Within 8 months of the birth of my son, I reduced my hours to part-time, and a year later, I quit that job. After my second child was born, I returned to an employer who has a breastfeeding mother-friendly designation. At my request, they put blinds in my office. I have 2 other options of where to pump. People respect my space. They don't talk to me while I'm pumping. They don't knock on my door. As a result of the respect that I get from my employer, I took on more responsibility and was recently promoted. So I guess my point here today is that both my employers benefited from children who had very low incidence of illness while I was nursing. My current employer benefited from my increased commitment to my work. And what I learned is that not everyone will act appropriately. And I don't know if it's ignorance or malice or a combination of both, but I think that this issue is just too important to be left to chance. So I'm here asking your support for this bill.
Thank you very much. The last two people are Steve Lanning and Marcia Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We represent 180,000 union members throughout the state. This is one issue that we don't find in very many union contracts. It's just not spoken to. We think this bill, Senate Bill 618, is a good bill. We'd like to see it move forward this session. We think that it has a lot of flexibility in it for businesses to comply. We think it has safeguards for businesses that can't comply due to an undue hardship. And we'd like to see it move forward either this way or amended. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Marcia.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We support this bill. I'm glad that people pointed out the savings for employees not having sick children at home because of the benefits of breast milk. It's very important when we think of the working poor who are often working without insurance to be able to have the healthiest babies possible. Most all of the other points were already done. We appreciate this bill, and we'd support working with industry and business to make it more acceptable.
Thank you very much. And for everyone, I plan to move this bill. I'm not sure when it'll be scheduled. It'll be with amendments because I know the bill as is written now would not be able to pass on the floor of the Senate. I want to make sure that it can pass on the floor of the Senate. So I know that I've talked with Diane and AOI, and they're going to be getting together working on amendments. If they can't come up with agreeable amendments, I'm putting my own amendments in it so that it will pass on the floor. So with that, I thank everyone for being here, and I closing the work session on Senate Bill public hearing on Senate Bill 618, and I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 501. And Megan Sweeney,
Gail McDougall,
and Gail McDougall, I think.
We have Joel separate.
Yeah.
I'll be right back. I will be right back. I'll bring chair. Can I go to the restroom? Are you asking? I can talk openly.
Peter. Yes, Mother.
There's no further public question. I'm not going to use for a second while we're here in the room.
Okay, we're recessing while things get cleared out here.
Chair Monis Anderson, and I was going to say members of the committee, but Chair Monis Anderson.
They'll be right back.
All right. My name is Megan Sweeney. I'm the Executive Director of the SEIU Oregon State Council. The SEIU State Council works on joint legislative and political efforts that impact the 42,000 home care workers, health care workers, public employees, and janitors.
Will you please shut the door in the back? Thank you.
Who are members of the two SEIU locals in the state. I'm here to testify in support of the amended SB 501. We came to support SB 501 after an evaluation of the toll that skyrocketing health care costs were having on workers, families, and Oregon taxpayers. Oregonians can't afford these increases. Health insurance premiums rose 13% in 2002, 14% in 2003, and an estimated 14% in 2004, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. SEIU Local 503 represents 22,000 state employees who receive health care coverage from the Public Employee Benefit Board. Between 2000 and 2003, which is the most recent data that we have available, the amount that PEB paid Regents for inpatient services jumped 47.5%, but utilization increased just 7%. At the same time, cost per claim from Regents for outpatient services increased 31%. In every case, the cost is outpacing our utilization. Oregon's businesses, Oregon's citizens, and the taxpayers deserve accountability and answers that explain these skyrocketing health care costs. Many insurance company administrators will claim that the explanation for these rising health care costs is somewhere else. With our aging population, with the use of new technology, with the drug companies. We recognize that this bill is just a small piece to a big puzzle, and if we had a silver bullet, we wouldn't be here. Yet this is a needed reform that takes a crucial first step. The contents of the Oregon Health Forum's 2004 annual insurance report sums up many of our concerns and elucidates the reasons that we need accountability on the rate-setting process. They say, quote, over the past 10 years, Oregon's health insurance have fared significantly better than the people they insure. Quote, company profits are on the upswing. Quote, insurance executives in Oregon have been paid handsomely. In fact, according to the report, Oregon's insurance companies made $47 million in profit in 2003 and $78 million in profit in 2001 and 2002. Their report shows that the medical loss ratio, which refers to the percentage of premium dollars actually spent on medical care versus the administrative costs and profit, vary dramatically. Kaiser's aggregate data shows 96% of premium dollars are spent on health care, compared to LifeWise, for instance, where less than 80% of premium dollars are actually spent on health care. Disclosure and accountability are the new buzzwords of healthcare, and we are considering policy options that demand hospitals to be more transparent and that would require drug companies to reveal how much they spend on advertising and gifts to doctors. Insurance companies should not be exempt from those requirements. Some insurance companies spend more on healthcare services and some spend more on administrative costs, the Kaiser LifeWise example. Economists argue that in order for the market to work effectively, consumers need accurate information and complete information to make these good decisions. The bill gives consumers these tools to choose between insurers. It also helps policymakers get a handle on what's driving these rate increases. Insurers will claim that no one uses the current DCBS website and that no one will use this information provided in the amended SB 501. We disagree. DCBS reports that 2.6 million visitors to their website in 2004, www.oregoninsurance.org. That's up 16% from 2003. I've attached a copy of the website's homepage to my testimony. Imagine if there was a column on the website that said, click here for more information about your insurance carrier. Now, savvy consumers have to click to multiple sites and addresses and finally end up outside of the Oregon Insurance website at the National Association of Insurance Carriers. There you can download a 7-point font, 50 to 75 page report. I have an example of one here. So, you can see. That gives some information on costs and expenditures. But imagine instead a common 1-to-2-page sheet that reported profit, CEO salary, medical loss ratio, rate increases, reserves, and contingency funds. This would receive even more than 2.6 million visits. The insurance claim that all this information is already public. This is not true. DCBS does not collect information about rate increases from large group plans. That's anything over 25 people enrolled. There is nothing in these reams of paper that talk about rate increases. Small businesses have little negotiating power and are more vulnerable to the rising premiums. However, current statute mandates that the information carriers share with DCBS about their small business policies is classified and treated as a trade secret. We think that this should be revisited, and the public deserves to know more about what is driving small business rate increases. And I just want to make clear that I am talking about the amendments to 501, which was dramatically different than the original bill. Okay. The information collected and available at the NAIC website is not collected by plan size. This bill would change that. It is and what's currently available is aggregate data for all their policies. In this bill, carriers would file information for three groups of policy sizes, 2 to 25, 26 to 50, and over 50. This allows for more apples-to-apples comparison and let us look at what's driving cost increases in the smaller markets. The information collected currently is different. It does not include premium increases, will also look at the actual value of the plan. While these reports have a line item for general administrative expenses, consumers don't know what these costs are. They don't know CEO salaries. The carriers may claim that this is another costly bureaucratic request that will add to premium costs. If transparency is expected to lower hospital costs, then the same should apply to insurance costs. If this information that is already collected, then it should be easily available. We do not want something cumbersome or burdensome, but something easy to read and understand. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Sweeney. Questions? Okay, who's next?
Hi, thank you for allowing me to be here today, Chairman Sanderson and members of the committee. I'm Reverend Gail McDougall, and I am the senior pastor of First Congregational United Church of Christ here in Salem. I would like to share with you a couple of very brief observations about Oregon healthcare realities from where I sit, four blocks from here, and then a specific case in point about Senate Bill 501. I came to serve First Congregational United Church of Christ in downtown Salem. It will be 7 years ago this next August. And two things related to health and healthcare have happened in those 7 years. Number one, the people who ring our doorbell seeking help used to ask for help with their rent, their utility bills, and food assistance. Very, very occasionally, 7 years ago, would someone ask for assistance in paying for a prescription or for some form of medical care. Now, after an audit of last year's help from what is called our pastor's discretionary fund, I note that 30% of the people coming to our doors need some form of assistance with their medical needs, mostly needing help in paying for prescriptions. With each cut in the Oregon health plan and with the skyrocketing cost of health insurance in general, more desperate people, especially diabetics and asthma patients, are fearful for their lives should they not be able to get the prescriptions they need. Some come with raging infections as well and do not know where to go for help. Of course, we have to send them to the ER despite the fact that an infected finger or knee and a sore throat are not best treated most effectively or cost effectively in the ER, but that's what's available. And what happens when they leave the ER, of course, is they have a prescription. And they have no money to fill the prescription. And so this vicious cycle repeats itself time and time again. And I find this appalling in our state and nation. So that's kind of a context for my next comments. I'm going to take off my clerical collar and I'm going to put on a small business administrator's hat because, yes, churches are small businesses. We have four employees eligible for coverage with health care or health insurance. One denied her coverage by saying, I will be on my husband's. And then mine is a separate one because it comes from the denomination. And the two other employees are on an Oregon-provided provider's health care plan. And our contract renews each April 1st. In anticipation of the double-digit kind of increases, our experience over the past 4 to 5 years, the very ones that Megan spoke about, we thought a healthy 15% increase into the 2005 church budget. I have provided copies of you, Senators, of the actual rates that we will be paying as of Friday this week. On one side of the sheet is our 2004 rate of $414.80 per person per month. Our 2005 rate increases by 36% to $566.60 at the same time that the co-pays and the out-of-pocket maximums are doubling. 36%. No explanation was offered and none was given. Shop elsewhere, it matters not. Our broker went to work for us to try to find something else that we could do for our employees. And the several competitor plans with similar coverages that we checked were no better. How can any small business, especially a not-for-profit one, afford these unexplained and out-of-control increases year after year? This is so far beyond anything that we think of in terms of inflation, even if we factor in this is inflation in the medical field. And I feel that this is not fathomable. It is time to make this broken system more transparent and accountable for the good of all Oregonians. To receive a 36% increase in premiums and not be able to track the whys and the wherefores, or should I say, the to whoms these increased benefits are being paid, is simply, in my mind and in my moral universe, not acceptable. This kind of information may not lower the rates, though I suspect it might have a chilling effect, but it will create the kind of accountability that we deserve given our system and given the fact that I think the once pretty high trust between insurance providers and their clients is dying.
in the face of these unaccounted for and extreme increases. Thank you for your time. I'll take questions.
Mr. Nesbitt.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the AFL-CIO in Oregon, and speaking again on behalf of the 180,000 working people who are represented by the affiliates of our organization, almost all of whom have health care, all of them bargained for health care, and all of them are seeing a larger and larger share of their total compensation going to health insurance costs, and for many of our members as well, a bigger and bigger chunk of their paychecks. You've heard in prior testimony on other bills that the biggest cost drivers for health care cost increases come from hospital care and prescription drugs, both of which lack transparency in pricing and price their services and products very often on who the buyer is rather than what a fair price for the product or service would be. But when insurance companies not only pass on those costs, hospital costs and prescription drug costs, but mark them up with their own administrative charges, they become part of the problem. And especially when we see insurance premiums rising faster than the component costs of care. So Senate Bill 501 offers a modest solution that will increase the transparency of insurance company pricing and enable consumers, especially small employers and smaller group health plans, to make apples-to-apples comparisons when shopping for, selecting, and hopefully bargaining with their insurance companies for the insurance, for the premium pricing for their plans. Now, I would be the first to acknowledge that not all insurance companies use a blind kind of cost-plus approach to pricing their final product. In fact, some of them are doing a better job than others in terms of prescription drug bulk purchasing by pooling their efforts around a common formulary. That can make sense. That can help lower costs. But not all have similar admin costs, as Megan Sweeney's testimony confirmed. And, in fact, there's a big range in terms of the cost-plus versus the cost-plus-plus or plus-plus-plus approach that you sometimes see if you really examine the pricing practices of these plans. Now, the largest employer groups often have people they can hire as experts to kind of do that work for them. It's hard, it's not impossible to get the data, but it's really most easily obtained and most easily analyzed by the larger groups that can employ the experts to kind of take a look at the data and bargain with the insurance companies and get a better price. That's not the case for a lot of small employers. And remember, we have our healthcare system is based on employment-sponsored plans. And I sat through a hearing in this room Monday morning on another bill, a House bill, maybe it was next door, where we heard a lot of restaurant owners talking about the minimum wage. But the point was half of them, all of them said they'd like to provide health insurance. I think about half of those who testified said they did, and all of them complained about the high cost of health insurance for small employers. I think this kind of a bill offers the transparency and information we need to allow small employers in particular to do a better job of shopping for, selecting, and bargaining for a good price when it comes to health insurance, and ensure them that the prices they pay are reasonable and not overly inflated on top of those underlying, already fast-growing, overly inflated costs for hospital care and prescription drugs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Will you stick around? I want to call Joel Ario up, and then we might. I have some specific questions, but some of them might be answered by him. So, yeah, step down and then, but stay close.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Before I get into the boring details of insurance regulation here, I do want to say that my wife is currently breastfeeding our third child at only a mere 9 weeks, and she would want me to say for the record that she supports breastfeeding as strongly as your wife, Senator Cruz. So I don't know if Ben's going to get the 22 months, as I heard the testimony, but he'll go past 9 weeks anyway. Insurance regulation and Senate Bill 501. We're here today to support the two broad concepts that are in the dash one amendments. We think this bill has much more potential to actually have some impact on the insurance marketplace as opposed to the original bill, which I think would have created a fairly unwieldy new rate review board. This one works with the current system, and I think quite reasonable and sort of modest steps. I took note of the fact that Megan described it as a small piece of a much bigger puzzle, and I think that's correct. We ought not to delude ourselves that this bill will provide a major impact on rates, but I do think the two broad concepts here are important ones. Let me start with the first one, which is transparency. Today, there's quite a bit of transparency in insurance rate regulation. We try to be as transparent as we can. This bill would improve that, though. This bill would say that when rate filings are made, they become public record on the day they're filed with us. Today, that is not true in all markets. It is true in some. In the individual market today, absent an argument about trade secret protection, the rate filing is public the day it's filed. But in the small group market, there is in current law a total blanket protection for the confidentiality of the rate filing. This bill would remove that, and it also would remove the trade secret argument for other kinds of rate filings. I think there's some things that need to be tweaked in the language here. It's been pointed out to me by the carriers that the way the bill reads currently, it says all filings with the department by health carriers would become public record. There are other kinds of filings besides rate filings that I think that would not be advisable to do. So I think the bill needs to be limited to rate filings, which I think is the intent of the proponents here. But we think that kind of transparency, as Megan said again, transparency we think will help with hospital rates. Transparency helps with prescription drug prices, and we think it helps in insurance rate regulation. Now, I do know the carriers are going to get up after me and say that they're still looking at this more carefully and that there may be things in those filings that they think need to still be protected, and we'll keep an open mind about that. But we've asked pretty probing questions before, up until today, about exactly what is it in these filings that you think needs to be protected, and haven't really gotten a clear answer. And I doubt you'll get a clear one today, and I think you have a right to say if you can't give us clear reasons for specific things that need to be protected, then we ought to have transparency. I mean, I would, when people say to me, how do you guys figure out whether the rate increase is justified or not? And I have to say, well, trust us, we do it right, but we can't give you the details. I don't think that's helpful to public confidence, and I think a more transparent process would be a good one. So we support that aspect of the bill. And in fact, I think the transparency may be the most important part of the bill. The second part of the bill, data reporting, we also support in concept. It will be pointed out by a number of people. I think it's already been pointed out by Megan that much of this information is in some form or fashion already available, but it's not available in the simple, easy to compare way. I got to tell you, I had the language of the current -1 amendments run by my technical people, and what I got back was some fairly cumbersome, complicated answers that I think still don't quite get us to the simple one or two page disclosure statement that we're after. So we would like the opportunity to work with both the proponents of the bill and the carriers to see if we can get down to something where we can really say for these plans, these are the medical loss ratios, these are the administrative costs. I will tell you today that I doubt that LifeWise agrees with the proposition that they're 16 points higher in administrative costs than Kaiser. They'll say, well, that's because they count certain things differently than we count them and so forth. But we can try to work through that detail, and I'm not sure we'll get there, but we would be happy to work with both parties to try to get to something that is easy and both easy to understand and comparable, so that we're talking apples to apples. I think the hardest part of that, frankly, is going to be this kind of trying to divide the thing into the 2 to 25 market, the 26 to 50, and the 50 and above, because that's not information we currently get in that form. But I think there are very good public policy reasons for trying to get it, and I think we ought to try to work with people, see if we can get there on those things. So my testimony today is to be generally in support of this and be willing to work with both the proponents and opponents of the bill to see if we can improve, particularly on the second part of the bill.
Okay, I have a question. Are you involved with IPGB at all?
I try to stay as far away from Rocky as I can. Rocky kind of floats out there with IPGB over
right.
here, but we work together as colleagues.
What I want to know is when we have contracts, when we develop contracts with, say, Regents, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and we get a discount, okay, is that public? If we get
a discount, I mean, rate compared to, you know, a contract with Regions and some other company? I mean, is that
Madam
public?
Chair, I assume you're now talking about these new plans that they've just developed under the legislation from the prior session, the so-called low-cost plans.
Well, where I'm going is I there are some things that I feel should not, that in order to stay competitive, and I'm still not convinced that we shouldn't have competitiveness in the insurance business. And so where I'm going with this is I don't have a problem with the seven things that are listed here. I think they're great. And I just wanted to know, there are deals that are going to be made with insurance companies and individual big corporations and, you know, different businesses. And that's where I don't want to step on anyone's toes. And I'm not sure where the proponents, where I need input from Mr. Nesbitt and Ms. Sweeney regarding that. But I wanted to get a sense of what we are doing right now with our small businesses. I mean, is it, are we pretty transparent about the deals? I hate to call them deals, but the contracts that we make?
Madam Chair, it's a very, very good question, and that's the detail I want to hear more from the carriers on as well. But I will say in broad concept here, there are two different issues in the question you ask. One is, what is the price for the product? What are the premium prices? Those numbers are public. I mean, you get them off the web page, what numbers we approve for what level of premium, for what level of benefit, and so forth. Behind those numbers are a number of components to the cost, and some, you know, if Regent's price is $220 for a plan, and Kaiser's is $210 for the same plan, there will be different numbers behind that as to what kind of price they're paying for what kind of services through what kind of providers. And some of those numbers, I think people would make a very good argument, ought to be kept confidential. If every plan knows exactly what the discount rate for every hospital is for every other plan, and they know exactly what the per capita rate is for physicians and so forth, you're going to start to undermine competition. Although I will also tell you that the plans have a pretty good idea of what each of the other plans is has negotiated, but there is some aspect of confidentiality, but that's at a level of detail below these broad concepts like the premium price. Everybody can look at Regent's price for a given product, but those things are already disclosed on our webpage. So there clearly are some of these things and administrative costs and those sorts of things. If we can figure out a way to standardize them that is comparable, I don't think you're dealing with the disclosure of any competitive secrets there.
The second question I have is, do we already have a website in DCBS that posts insurance, like FEOP, all the different programs? Do we have a website?
Madam Chair, yes, we do. It's more like, though, as it was characterized, I think, that if anything, there's too much information up there. We have volumes of information, and it's more the issue here, I think, is that, you know, I'd like some information, and you get a truckload of information, then you have to try to sort through the truckload to figure out what it is that you really wanted. And so it's trying to take the huge volume of information that's out there and boil it down into a few data points that are more easy to understand, and secondly, and probably certainly as important, comparable, so that you can say this number here is comparable and can be measured against this number over here.
Okay. All right. Let's go with John Powell, Walt Sander Duroff, and Ed
Niebert.
Thank
you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ed Niebert. I'm the Director of Regulatory Affairs for Providence Health Plan. I want to make a few brief remarks about the concept of disclosure of health insurance information that you've already heard something about from earlier testimony. I'm going to try to avoid repetition of that as I sort of jump through my notes here. First of all, I want to point out that the kind of disclosure that in concept is proposed in the amendments is not new or or wholly unavailable. As has been commented, much of this information, I would say most all of this information, is currently required and reported by insurers annually to the insurance division on the same reporting date, in fact, in the amendments, March 1st. And it's fully available to the public. Now, the availability is through paper photocopies, not through the website, unless you want to go through the sort of the detailed searching of the web and end up at the NAIC, where this information gets eventually from the insurance division. Insurers certainly would not object to making that more easily available directly through the division website. I think the key question before the committee is the usefulness of this information to members of the public. The current reporting, as been said, is very detailed, and it's very detailed for a particular purpose. It's intended for the regulator to view closely the financial status of the company to see that they're sound and solvent and engaged in fair practices, etc. The proposal in the Dash 1 amendments would distill that information into a few clearer, simpler, more useful, we would hope, categories. And again, that distillation of the current information, I don't think you'd find any objection from insurers on that. It would also, though, add some new categories that are not in the current reporting, namely a breakdown of financial information by market segment. Today, Providence Health Plan serves all three segments of the employer market. Small employers, 2 to 25, I'll call them sort of small employers, 26 to 50, and then large employers, greater than 50. We report all the financial information in our annual report, but we report it in aggregate, which is what the annual report calls for. For us to break that down by market segment would take a fair bit of additional work and, in fact, a bit of arbitrary assignment of numbers. For instance, our assets, the stocks and bonds that we hold in reserve to pay claims and to run the business, there's no allocation of those between small employer and large employer and medium employer. There'd have to be some rule of thumb to say how you arbitrarily allocate that kind of thing. Again, the proposed disclosure in the Dash 1 amendments is intended to shed light on the financial status of the insurer and changes in their premium rates. A snapshot of those issues can be derived from the current reporting, but again, it can be derived on an aggregate basis, not a market segment basis. I think it's questionable, frankly, whether that snapshot would be more useful to the general public on a market segment basis, again, because some of it would be an arbitrary breakdown of data, but I think it's questionable whether it would be more useful. In closing, I would just add that I think insurers are certainly comfortable with easier access to the reporting that we already provide, certainly comfortable with distilling that reporting down to be more user-friendly and simpler, and I would say we would also be comfortable with discussing how we could do that, how we could make that information more user-friendly and meaningful to people.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Walt Samadurov. I'm the Director of Underwriting for HealthNet Plans of Oregon. And HealthNet offers group, individual, Medicare, and we provide PPO products, HMO, and POS. Also, we provide life, dental, vision, and pharmacy, so we're a broad-based carrier. I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments on the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 501. Speaking to the Dash 1 amendment, both the broad language in Section 2, Sub 1, and the deletion of reference to proprietary trade information in ORS 743.737 proposed in Section 3 and 4 cause concerns for us. Currently, rate information is submitted for review and approved by the Department of Consumer and Business Service and is held proprietary, is not available to the general public. And that certain pieces are, but the part that's the rating factors are held as proprietary. Maintaining rate information as proprietary allows carriers like ourselves to remain competitive on pricing and innovative on product design. Despite the challenges of increasing healthcare costs, Oregon has been successful in maintaining competitive health insurance market with 10 plus carriers that we currently have. So that's a big plus for us. Competition benefits purchasers and consumers by providing a market that delivers the best product at the best possible rate for the consumer. If proprietary trade information on health insurance rate were made public, the result would be reduced competition and stifled innovation as far as benefit design and offering products that the consumers could afford or groups could afford to buy. Although the Department of Consumer and Business Services maintains rate information as proprietary, they have a broad regulatory role in assuring that the rates are scrutinized in the consumer's interest. Both rates and benefits are reviewed and must receive prior approval by the department before a product goes to the market. The department performs an important role in protecting the public interest by ensuring the financial soundness of the insurer, the availability and affordability of insurance, and the fair treatment of policyholders and claimants while maintaining a positive business climate. Finally, as was just spoken, HealthNet believes in transparency, and there are ways we could work together to find craft language and find a way to be able to show some of the information that's being requested.
Questions?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair, I might preface my remarks with a few statements about broader issues and then more specific to the amended bill at hand. I'm going to take, I can't give credit to whoever said this, and I've ticked myself several times not clipping it out of a magazine I saw maybe waiting for a doctor in a doctor's office. But the statement was something like, talking about things you know very little or nothing about has turned into a national pastime in America. And I'll have to plead guilty to a certain extent today, because the technical nature of rate filings and that sort of thing, I have a very limited knowledge of. My friend here from HealthNet would know much more than I, but I'm going to talk anyway because it is a national pastime and I have a right to talk. So, having said that, no industry is regulated to the extent that insurance is. Every word in the forms and policies that are used are submitted and approved. Rating regulation is almost unprecedented. At the same time, we're competitive. And unlike utility rate regulation, in many cases where there is a monopoly or near monopoly, we're competitive at the same time. So it does create a uniqueness in terms of how we do business and how we are regulated. Many decisions made by people who sat in those chairs that you're in today, who sat there before, have added more to that whole regulatory scheme. And to a certain extent, and to the most part, there is some sense to that madness. And a lot of money is spent, administrative money is spent, complying with all of those rules and regulations, down to how long we have to pay medical providers. And so many days, and if we do not, we pay interest on it. So, to a large extent, this industry is micromanaged, and micromanaged by the legislature, and has the competitive pressure on it at the same time. It is, transparency is a worthy goal, both in terms of the medical providers and insurers. However, insurers are all organized differently. For the most part, we have a different basis as to how we operate. Kaiser's been mentioned earlier. Kaiser is a great model for consumers, and it provides a lot of competitiveness to the marketplace. But it is one thing for a closed panel provider to have a different administrative rate than an insurer that pays for almost any provider you go to anywhere in the state. So there are differences in how they operate, which makes a difference in their administrative costs. Regents has contracts with most providers that some other types of insurers do not have. That gives us, at times, we think, a competitive advantage over some others in the market, particularly foreign insurers who are located outside of the state. So while we can do some things, we think, to give you and consumers a better view of the inside of the system, it is going to be very difficult for a consumer to click on one internet site and compare a figure on one line between a Kaiser and a LifeWise, for example, and know exactly what those figures mean, simply because they are different organizations organized differently and have reasons to have different administrative costs. Why would maybe a HealthNet, which is a very small insurer, have a higher administrative cost in any one year than maybe a larger insurer? What if they needed to replace their computer system at a very high price? But without doing that, they cannot remain competitive because those systems now are what you can use to drive down your administrative costs. If you can't capitalize and invest in those things and amortize that and basically becomes part of your administrative costs, then you're going to become non-competitive eventually. So executives who run insurance companies have to make those types of decisions and calculations over time. So the point I'm trying to make, with a caveat that I don't know much about what I'm talking about, is they're different beasts with different problems at one point in time that they will have than they would have or be experiencing at a different point in time. More specifically to the amended bill at hand, we have had a meeting. I've known Ed for since when he had hair. I've not met this gentleman, but the health plans are looking at this amended version to see what we can possibly and humanly do to meet the confines, or at least what we can meet in terms of providing data that could be transmitted to DCBS for use on the internet and those types of devices. You should also know that while most people think any insurance company can simply go to a computer terminal, type in a request, and get all the data in any form that one might want, that is simply not the case. In fact, usually what happens when you have to retrieve data for the regulator, for example, is you have to write a program. You have to write a program to the computer to go in and do different kinds of searches. And to a certain extent, that can be done. But there's other data requests that you simply cannot meet because you have not kept data in that form or format.
And now, and looking at the seven items that would be, I mean, when you set up a budget, contingency fund, is that something sacred? Amount of reserves maintained, is that sacred? Amount of surplus maintained? I keep thinking that when you do a budget sheet every year, that's information that would be pretty easy to do. But these others, I don't understand
very
well.
And some of that information is collected, but if you turn the page, you have to report that data in three different increments, according to this bill.
Yes.
And that's what we don't know that we can do in all cases, because it hasn't been kept necessarily in that format by size of the policyholder, small group and large group. So that, yes, most of that stuff, as Mr. Niebert pointed out, much of this stuff is already reported on an annual basis to DCBS. And we can make that available. However, again, I'm not sure in line 19 what the actuarial value of the plan means in relationship to these points. If that means you have to somehow allocate all of the operation, as Mr. Niebert pointed out, your investment portfolio, your assets of the buildings, all of that to certain segments in point, we don't know exactly how that's meant to relate to these all of these various requirements. But we not sure actuarial value is a term of art. Again, I know very little about
how much time, how soon could you get together with Ms. Sweeney and Mr. Ario.
I think.
Or Ario, I think.
I don't know.
The answer is to both.
Dole. to give us a better sense of where we can go with this bill.
Madam Chair, just before this meeting we met, and hopefully by the end of this week we can get a conference call of health plan technical people together to give us their best shot at what is doable. So sometime hopefully next week.
Because what we're going for here is cost containment and transparency in the whole healthcare system, but not to the detriment of the system. I mean, everyone says our healthcare system is so bad, but there's a lot of good things about it. And so I would really like the industry to really come forward to see, okay, what is doable? Because I'm really pleased at the amendment and where we've gone with this, and now we need to hear from you to see where you are at. And I would like to we need to get out of here, and I apologize to Ms. Mary Beth Healy and Mr. Jim Davis, but I'm not sure we want to come back Monday. I'd rather wait to see what you have and to see if we have if we can work further. Is that all right, Ms. Healy, for you to wait? All right.
Madam Chair, okay. Two things. Yes. One, we also agree that the amendments are a giant stride forward in this legislative effort. Secondly, we take this very seriously, and we will, with all dispatch, work toward seeing what we can do to provide. And we're very much aware of your committee's timelines too.
If you could get back with Mr. Berkovian as to when
we will give Mr. Berkovian a report no later than Monday.
Okay, and then on Monday we'll decide when we will bring this back. Does that sound all right?
Thank you.
Thank you. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 501, and we are adjourned for the day.